next episode of GeoTalk, GPS navigation goes indoors, we review the Garmin Fenix GPS receiver, and we speak to the person who was first to find on the 2 millionth geocache. All this and more on GeoTalk. Well, welcome to episode 96 of GeoTalk for March 2013, and it's good to still be with you after what I've been through over the last couple of weeks. A bit more about that in a sec. Now, first of all, a bit of an apology to all our overseas listeners. It seems that some people didn't quite get the joke in the last episode about drop bears. Now, I have to confess that drop bears are actually a bit of an urban legend here in Australia, and it's something that we tell overseas visitors when they come to Australia, that they're there in the bush, along with bunyips and all sorts of other nasty creatures that we make up just to scare the heck out of people for no reason at all. It's not like we don't have enough nasties in Australia anyway when we go out geocaching. Anyway, one email that I thought I'd read out, and as you can tell, I'm actually outside in the backyard doing this episode, so you might hear the aeroplane buzzing me at the moment. One was from Richard, also known as Eagle Scout 1968, over in the US, and he says, I was listening to episode 95 in the segment on drop bears. I'd never heard of drop bears. I'd heard about koala bears, but not about their evil twin. I found the discussion interesting and informative, but as the discussion went on, I started to wonder if it was an April Fool's joke. When you and your guests got to the part where you were all talking about how to prevent attacks, I got suspicious. I believe it was mentioned that putting toothpaste on the back of your ears or some other odd-sounding things were mentioned. I think one of them was actually Vegemite, which is an evil black concoction that just about every kid in Australia eats on toast. Anyway, he stopped the podcast and checked online, and Wikipedia and other sites convinced him that it wasn't a joke. He says, I'd love to visit Australia someday. Thanks for your podcast. Well, it is actually a joke, but as I said, it's a joke that a lot of Australians love to pull on overseas visitors. And I should point out, too, koalas are not bears. They're actually marsupials. They look like a bear, but they're actually closely related to the kangaroo and other sort of marsupial animals that we find here in Australia. So anyway, sorry about everyone who got fooled by that. And I should also give a shout out to Suz Seaman and Super R, who are hosts of the Twin Cities Geocaching podcast over in Minnesota. They had a bit of fun with it. I think they knew that actually it was a joke. Well, Sir Seaman did anyway, and he mentioned it about halfway through the podcast. But look, check out their podcast whether you're from overseas or from the Minnesota region. I know that they are crying out for people in the Twin Cities area to call in and share their stories. Their website is TCGCPC, so that stands for Twin Cities Geocaching Podcast, TCGCPC.com, and have a listen to them. Now, as I mentioned in the last podcast, and some people have probably seen on forums and so forth, that unfortunately I had to undergo some fairly major surgery, and it all happened while I was putting together the last podcast. In fact, I only got it out just hours before I had to go into hospital. Just to let you know, I got diagnosed with a brain tumour about a few days earlier, and had to quickly go into hospital to have it removed. Now, the good news is it was all taken out, and I've recovered quite well. In fact, I was up walking and up and about within 24 hours of the surgery. That was the good news. The bad news is that, unfortunately, it was an aggressive form of malignant tumour, which means that I'm currently undergoing chemotherapy and radiotherapy for about 6 weeks, and I'm almost halfway through it. And I'm doing quite well, and hopefully in a few weeks' time, I'll find some good news out, and then over the next few months, we'll just see how things pan out. But a big thank you to everyone who have sent their wishes to me and their thoughts and prayers and everything else that they've done over the last few weeks. It's really meant a lot. I know that a lot of you have wanted to help, particularly those who are here in Sydney. But look, thanks very much for your thoughts. They've helped me get through, and I've been keeping in touch with the geocaching community over the last few weeks, and it's certainly encouraging me to get better and get out there. In fact, I have managed to find a few geocachers in the last few days, so certainly cheered me up somewhat. Now, in geocaching news, there was an interesting article by Asher Moses in the Sydney Morning Herald that I thought I'd share with you. I'll give you a link in the show notes, and you can find those show notes at geotalkpodcast.com. And the article is entitled Google Maps and Other Navigation Indoors. And he writes, Google has launched indoor maps in Australia, allowing users to find their way around inside airports, shopping centres, train stations and other large buildings using mobile devices. Australian engineers at firms such as Navisons, CSIRO and the University of New South Wales are leading the world in developing advanced indoor navigation technology capable of helping people locate specific products on supermarket shelves, tracking athletes' performance, or guiding the visually impaired. UNSW is beginning trials this week on technology to help visually impaired people navigate indoors. He goes on to say that the indoor Google Maps technology, which uses nearby Wi-Fi networks and mobile towers rather than GPS to determine your location, is available for about 200 indoor locations across the country. And at the moment, a lot of those include many Westfield shopping centres and Stockland and Centro shopping centre floor plans, along with train stations in Sydney and Melbourne, Sydney Airport, Melbourne Airport, Adelaide Airport, several IKEA stores, and I know from many people who have been to IKEA, you can really do with that, along with sports venues such as Hisense Arena, Rod Laver Arena, Etihad Stadium and ANZ Stadium, and also a few cultural venues such as the National Gallery of Australia and the Sydney Opera House. So I'll give you a link in the show notes. You can check out all about that. But who knows, in the future, we might have geocaches being hidden indoors. Now, about 2 years ago, I received for Christmas a Garmin Nuvi. I think it's a 1350. It was a second-hand one, but it was one that we thought would be good for inside the car, particularly if we were going interstate or travelling outside the area we know. And I noticed that a friend of mine, Zell Goriath, had a TomTom, and he was able to put in geocaches into it, and they were coming up quite large and quite visible on his GPS. And I thought, what a great idea. Now, unfortunately, I found that the Garmin units, particularly the Nuvis, the older Nuvis, don't do it so easily. Now, I've tried various different macros that attach to GSAC, but it's only been in the last sort of few months that I've really worked out an ideal way of doing it so that they come up quite large and they're easy to find. And it's using a section of the Nuvi called the favorites section. Now, I've put together some notes on how to do it, and I've put it up on my blog. I'll give you a link in the show notes, but you can find it on my own personal blog under darrenosborne.com, and if you go into the geocaching section, you'll find it there. But already I've had a bit of positive feedback from people who have had just the same sort of struggles that I've had with trying to get these into their GPS device. And I should also point out, it was actually inspired by my visit about a year and a half ago to Hamilton, when I was in the car with Radio Nut 50, and he had a Nuvi device and he was doing a similar thing. So thanks very much, Alan, for inspiring me to persevere and to try and work out how to do it. But I'll give you a link in the show notes and you can check that out. Now, unless you've been living under a geocache or a rock, you would have known by now that geocaching.com celebrated its 2 millionth active geocache recently. Certainly amazing to think that there are 2 million geocaches out there around the world. Knowing how many are popping up in Sydney, I'm not surprised, to be honest. But congratulations to Peter, also known as Rampart_1 over in Alice Springs, who received the honour of hiding the 2 millionth geocache, and also to The Ump, who's one of our local reviewers, who was the one that pressed the publish button. And from all accounts, it wasn't selected. It was just a random thing. It just happened to be number 2 million. And it just so happens, we actually caught up with the first to find a geocacher, the person who first found it, and we'll chat to him a little bit later in the podcast. And briefly, to round out news, it's nearly the equinox here in the southern hemisphere. That is the autumn equinox, which means that the days are starting to become shorter than the nights. So that'll occur, I think, on the 21st of March, if not the 22nd. And it's probably a good time to go out and check out on your geocaches now. After the summer rush, you've probably had lots of people finding and rehiding your geocache. It's probably a good time to go out there now before it starts to head into winter, into the cooler months, and have a check of your geocache. Make sure that they don't need any new logbooks or log sheets, whether the pens and pencils are working in there, and whether the swag needs to be cleaned up a little bit, or the location needs to be repaired, or the cache even needs to be relocated because of damage from continual visits. So always a good time of the year. I know I've done a bit of it. I checked on 3 geocaches the other day and ended up archiving a 4th one that wasn't there anymore. So why not use the equinox when we got 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of dark to go out and check on your geocache. Well, it's time now to head across the ditch over to New Zealand and catch up with Alan, Radio Nut 50, with the latest news from New Zealand.
Hi there to all geocaches from Radio Nut 50 in Hamilton, New Zealand, with some caching comment over from this country. If you're one of those who rarely glance at the banner at the top of geocaching.com when you log in, you may not have noticed that there's a message bin at the top with a slowly incrementing counter for the past week or so. Groundspeak was working up to the 2 millionth active cache. The magic number was reached, and it was an Australian cache. Well done, guys. It was one called Overwatch Number 1, located in Alice Springs. How about that for a remote spot? Now, Butterfly Lady and I did some caching in Alice a few years ago, and it was certainly a memorable experience, with hot, dry conditions and wide open spaces. I see that cache now has 2 finds logged, 2 DNFs logged, and 1,659 write notes, mostly congratulating the user for being that 2 millionth cache. I bet that gave them a heck of a surprise. This does bring forward a question, though. How many actually log on to geocaching.com at all these days? I certainly find that using my smartphone or tablet with one of those mini caching applications is certainly a heck of a lot quicker and less frustrating. Just having to re-enter the username and password every time I go on the web page because I use different computers at different places, and the generally slow responses drives me to use the apps because they log themselves in behind the scenes and display exactly what I want. Coupled with using GSAK database as my main source for planning caching trips, etc., and now it being fully automatically updated from a series of queries on geocaching.com, I really need to log into the webpage anymore. I wonder what other people do. While noting there's been some pretty wet weather reported from some locations in Australia recently, bringing miserable and tragic floods to some, the past 2 months here in New Zealand have been absolutely fantastic weather for caching. We've had long sunny days, almost continuously, and it certainly shows in the logs. We're getting a steady stream of finds coming in on our caches, and we've taken advantage of this also to enjoy some fun out there ourselves. Autumn is certainly arriving now, though, with the days shortening and getting a little bit cooler, but in this part of our country it's still dry, and in fact droughts have been declared. Our sympathies go to those linked with the land. But we should make hay while the sun shines, they say, and that can be translated to find your caches while the sun shines. It's really a good opportunity to get out there now, as in a month or two, finding days without rain or cold will actually be quite a lot harder. This weekend, Linda and I are planning a walk through the old coach road near Owakuni, in the centre of the North Island, south of us here. We've done some section of this walk before, but we had to walk back to our car each time and go from each end. This weekend, we've made an arrangement to be dropped off at one end and enjoy the whole walk. We'll be checking out the cache that we laid there last time on the historic Tainui Railway Viaduct, and we'll be carrying a few boxes, of course, and we might place a couple more to encourage others onto this marvellous walk or cycleway. Now, I see the new GPS, the Garmin 600, is getting a fair bit of publicity at the moment. I wonder how many people have got one of these for geocaching now. There's a fair bit of interest in the forums, but not really heard of anyone using one yet. They seem pretty interesting. We've got an Oregon 450 and it's served us pretty well, but it's got a rubberized cover over the power switch and that's starting to crack, so maybe it's pretty well time to do an upgrade soon. My main GPS is a Garmin Montana, which performs really well as a crossover working as our in-car navigator and a handheld caching machine, but Linda enjoys the Oregon more because it's of its smaller size and much easier to carry with the same equivalent features. So I wonder if the 600 isn't a good improvement or not. I see it actually is designed to work on the Russian Glasnost satellite system as well, so I wonder if that'll improve accuracy or just be another catchy idea. Power trails are pretty much old hat these days, but a small snippet of news I heard on podcacher.com recently did take me by surprise. There's a claim out for the longest power trail in the world, and it's called the Highway 125 Trail in the US. It's 675 miles long. What can I say? I guess you'll either love them or hate them after that. Okay, a bit of a summary of events coming up in New Zealand, in the North Island. The nearest one is the Tale of the Easter Bunny. It's here in Hamilton in our city on the 29th of March. That's Easter Friday. It's one where you hide Easter eggs and have a fun chase with the family. Then there's a Twin Coast Trail event with a Sitto following in Kaikaui on the 30th of March. There's two Sitto events planned in Whangarei on the 20th of April. And don't forget to register for that second New Zealand mega event. It's in Auckland on the 26th of October, New Zealand's long weekend for Labour Weekend. Looking in the South Island, there's an event called Barbie by the Broads. Curious name. That's in Nelson on the 17th of March. How about an event in Stewart Island? There's one there themed as pirates on the 26th of March. Those from outside our country may not be aware of this major third island in the New Zealand group. It's directly south of the South Island. It's quite a significant landmass, but it's pretty remote and pretty cold down there. I'm sure this has got to be the first event ever advertised in Stewart Island. Now, on the 21st of April, though, there's an event in Kaiapoi called Keep Calm and Carry, and it's followed by a Sitto event as well. Okay, it's time to put it back to you now, Darren. Real sorry to hear that you're not in the best of health at the moment, and I'm sure all of the listeners will join me in wishing you all the very best for this moment.
Well, it's time now for the GeoTalk trivia question for this episode, and it all relates to the 2 millionth active geocache. And the question is, if it took 3,594 days to get from one geocache to 1 million active geocaches, how long did it take to get from 1 million to 2 million? The answer to that at the end of the podcast. Well, many of you who are into geocaching would be aware of the 2 millionth geocache being placed quite recently. And for those of us in Australia, we've got quite a bit to celebrate because it was actually placed almost in the dead centre of the country, just outside of Alice Springs. And joining us on the podcast is the person who got the FTF on that cache, Ted, also known as TT Ted Zines from Alice Springs. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
First of all, tell us, how did you get into geocaching?
Actually, it was when I was living in Canada. I wanted a GPS, and I did some research and came across geocaching website. And that was pretty much it. And at that stage, I think, where we lived in Canada, there was one geocache. And so once I got the GPS, I found it. And that was it for about 6 months until we left Canada and came to Australia.
Mm-hmm. And what led you to Alice Springs?
Yes. we were living in Melbourne, and where we lived in Canada was a small little village of 10,000 people. And Melbourne was sort of a bit of a shock, a few more than 10,000 there. Mm. And we're pretty much getting ready to just pack up and buy a car and just travel around. And a job offer came up in Alice Springs with the Charles Darwin University. And, yeah, pretty much came up here. I just stayed at Charles Darwin for about 2 months and then moved on, but just stayed in Alice Springs.
Now, for those people who are from outside of Australia, Alice Springs is kind of a long way from everywhere. Can you briefly describe for us what the city or the town is like, how big it is, and, roughly what it's like geocaching in the area?
Well, it's small. It consists probably of about two streets in each direction is the CBD of Alice Springs. It has everything you need. We've got supermarkets, great ice cream shop, great restaurants. When we first came to Alice Springs, there was actually only two geocaches here. My wife and I placed the third one. And now there's probably close to about 100 and something in the area.
And are there many geocaches, active geocaches, playing the game there?
There's quite a few people come, usually during winter. In summer, it's just too hot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This January, we just broke the record. We had, I think, 30 days over 40 degrees every single day. So it's in summertime, it's just too hot to do anything. Mm-hmm. So usually in wintertime, starting about April, May, people start coming up for holidays. And it can get quite busy with geocaching. Yeah, I bumped into a few accidentally.
Right. Okay, now tell us a bit about this 2 millionth geocache that was recently placed. I understand that your first attempt wasn't successful, but it wasn't through any fault of your own.
No, the cache owner had switched two of the numbers and the coordinates around, which put us 500 meters out. And unfortunately, where we were, I couldn't sort of do anything about it. So I came back home again. And another geocacher had already from the States, I believe he was in Alaska. I'm not 100% sure. I'm trying to find out now. He had worked out the correct coordinates. They saved me a bit of hassle. So I plugged them into the GPS and then went out. And it's a pretty easy find. It's well hidden. But it is a bit of a scramble up a hill, and it's probably best done in the cooler months.
Mm-hmm. And it's a regular size from what I understand.
Yeah, it's quite nice. It's probably a 500 millimeter container. So it's a nice container. Some good swaps in it. Mm-hmm. It's probably worthwhile finding.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've noticed when I look at the cache page, it's almost impossible to find your log because it's buried in about 1,500 plus congratulation comments from around the world. And have you likewise received a lot of email traffic from people around the world congratulating you on the first to find?
I found quite a few, yes. There's probably about 20 so far, which is great if they send it to you personally, but I kind of think it does clutter the page up a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, it makes it a bit difficult to find anything of any relevance.
If people are planning to come to Alice Springs to find this geocache, are there any tips that you would give them? I mean, you mentioned coming in the cooler months, sort of around the middle of the year from about May, but what other tips would you give to people who are looking for that particular cache or any caches around the Alice Springs area?
Even in the cooler months, there are some sort of good ones at the historic Kilograph Station. There's some sort of easier ways to find that are close to civilization. Generally, if you're going to find some of the more outside ones, take a lot of water, let people know where you are, because it's quite easy not to have communications in Alice Springs. You can lose your mobile phone signal and, I think about 20 kilometers out of Alice Springs, you get no radio stations, no mobile phones, nothing. So it is always good to let people know where you're going and what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. And of course, like most parts of Australia, but I suppose more so like Central Australia, lots of nasty critters such as snakes and all sorts of other bikies out there.
Fortunately, I haven't actually ever come across any.
Including drop bears? I suppose you haven't encountered drop bears in the
area. No, we don't get any of those here. No. We don't have the right kind of gun tree for that.
Right.
Yeah, no, they're sort of strictly on the coastal region. I think that probably the most dangerous thing I've ever come across is redback spiders.
Right.
But I keep them as pets, so they're not really something to worry about for me.
And for yourself, do you have any goals for 2013 as far as geocaching goes? Do you get to visit other places around the country and go caching there?
One of the nice things about living in Alice Springs is you sort of equal distance from everywhere. Generally we go away once a year. Both my wife and I get 8 weeks leave a year, so this year we're planning on a trip to Tasmania. That's probably the only state we haven't visited and haven't cached in. So, it's kind of something we're really looking forward to.
It's been great to speak to you, Ted, and congratulations once again on getting the first to find on the 2 millionth active geocache on the planet, and all the best with your trip to Tasmania and with your future geocaching adventures.
Thanks very much.
Well, it's time now to have a look at some of the events that are occurring around the country. And before we do, an apology to Grizz4B, who's a regular caller who calls in from Bathurst over in central west of New South Wales. He had an amazing event out in the Blue Mountains, and hopefully we'll hear from him in the not-too-distant future about how the event went. But if you didn't get to go to it, here's a preview of the event that he called in a few weeks ago to give you a taste of what it was all about.
Hey Spindoc, hope you're faring well, and medical miracles are indeed happening as we speak. It's Joel Hasdyke, or Grizz4B, calling in from Bathurst. And I'm calling to advertise an event called Where Exactly? How to Find a Flagstaff. The code is GC4507C. The event is scheduled for March the 10th from 2 to 4 p.m., and this geocaching event was established to celebrate the placing of a flagstaff by Governor Macquarie almost 200 years ago. This Bathurst flagstaff is synonymous with the crossing of the Blue Mountains, the naming of Bathurst, and the opening of the interior of Australia to survey and exploration. Now, the Bathurst flagstaff was used as the official terminus of the infamous Cox's Road over the mountains and was the earliest gazetted structure in inland Australia. It's even older than the Macquarie Obelisk in the Sydney CBD. Unfortunately, it was removed sometime in the late 1800s. But we're also hoping this will be more than a geocaching event. It's also part of the Bathurst Autumn Heritage Festival, which has events held throughout March, April, and May around the region. You can get more info on this from Bathurst Tourism at visitbathurst.com.au. But on the 10th of March, what we plan to do is to host a public family-friendly event to demonstrate a wide range of survey technology used from the early settlement of Australia all the way to today, to investigate the techniques that people have used to locate themselves before and since we've started to take advantage of GPS, and to see a raft of visiting surveyors and whether they can determine the original location of the flagstaff using original maps and plans and field notes from the early 1800s alongside our own high-tech GPS devices. And, of course, we want to swap a bit of geo swag and geo stories along the way. So we hope to see you there on March the 10th in Bathurst. Check out the code GC4507C, and rock on up. See you later. Bye.
And once again, thanks Grizz4B for sending in that description of the event, and hopefully it was successful, and hopefully we'll hear from you about how it went in the not-too-distant future. Now, some of the other events that are occurring around the country. On the 20th of March is the Dawn Mob in the Autumn, being held in Brisbane. On the 24th of March is the Beehive Yourself on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, just south of Port Macquarie. On the 27th of March, Fish and Chips Picnic at City Beach over in West Perth in WA. On the 30th of March is the Easter Geocache Hunt being held in Ballarat in central Victoria. On the 30th of March is the Easter at Home 2, Farewell to Emma. That's being held in the northern suburbs of Melbourne over in Macleod. On the 31st of March, there's the Letsito Little Para Trail No. 6 over in the northern suburbs of Adelaide in South Australia. And also Nearly a Date Palindrome over in Darwin. And also on the 31st is the Easter Feaster being held in Mount Gambier in the southeast of South Australia. And finally, on the 6th of April is X Marks the Spot. That's being held at Thalser Park in the southern suburbs of Adelaide in South Australia. So there's events occurring all around the country, or just about all around the country. It's good to see. If you've got any events that you want to publicise, don't forget to give us a call and hopefully we'll get them in time. Otherwise, you can check out the events dashboard, which is on the Geocaching Australia website. If you head to geocaching.com.au and you'll find the dashboard there and click on the events section and you'll get a listing of all the events that are occurring around the country, not only on the geocaching.com website, but also on other websites. It's time to head down south to the ACT to one of our regular contributors, Jeremy, also known as Noikmeister, who's done a bit of a review of the Garmin Fenix. He's a very avid and very keen bike rider, and he's taken the Fenix for a bit of a whirl and given his thoughts on how this fairly small but useful GPS device works.
Hello, GeoTalk listeners. It's Jeremy from Canberra here, also known as Noikmeister. here to give you a review on a brand new Garmin device called the Garmin Fenix. Santa was very good to me and I took delivery of one of these on Christmas Day. If you don't know what the Fenix is, it's a wrist-worn GPS. It's in a range of three, with the 4X301, 4X401, and then the Garmin Fenix, which is the top of the line. But essentially, it's a crossover device that's part watch, part fitness GPS, and part handheld trail walking GPS. This review is going to be broken up into four sections, and I will start with the section on GPS stuff. So, first and foremost, it's a GPS. It supports all the things you'd expect out of a handheld Garmin, which includes but not limited to a worldwide base map, which can't be added to, you can't add more maps to it, paperless geocaching, waypoint projection, waypoint averaging, tracking and track back. Aside from the lack of maps and a touchscreen, I couldn't find anything that I could do on my Montana that I couldn't do on the Fenix. Tracking with the GPS runs in two different modes. You can have normal mode, which samples just like your normal GPS would, or ultra track, which only takes samples every minute and can extend the battery life whilst tracking up to 50 hours. Perfect for the ultra marathoner. Battery life on normal GPS mode is listed in the specs at 16 hours. Now, when you're not using the Fenix for anything else, it's pretty much a watch. So not only does it have normal functions like telling the time with alarms, with multiple different alarms, recurring alarms on different days of the week, or one-off alarms, a countdown timer and stopwatch, and a backlight, but the time's never out because it always syncs itself with the GPS system. So along with telling the time, it also has an array of sensors, including a temperature sensor, barometer, altimeter, and an electronic compass. Now, the sensors in the watch have two modes, they're in on-demand or always on. The default mode is on-demand. So when in the on-demand mode, the watch takes a sample whenever you press any of the buttons on the watch. It takes about 1.5 seconds to take the sample, and then all the buttons perform their normal function. After you leave it for a while and press one of the buttons again, it'll take another sample. In always-on mode, you get exactly what it sounds like. But the data pages on the watch, which I'll get to later, show trending data for the sensors. So instead of just showing what the current temperature is, it'll actually show you the current temperature plus a little graph along the bottom of the watch of what the temperature's been for the last 2 hours. Or on the barometric pressure data page, it'll show you the barometric pressure over the last 48 hours. Same with the altimeter. It'll give you an altimeter graph over the last certain number of hours. Battery life in watch mode is up to 6 weeks or up to 2 weeks in always-on sensor mode. As a watch, the unit is water resistant to 50 metres, and so it's perfect for those close to shore island caches or diving caches. In terms of wearability as an ordinary watch, I would say that it doesn't look out of place at all. It just looks like a chunky dive watch, and its face is smaller than some of the expensive timepieces you see in shop windows these days. So I know this is the part you've all been waiting for. What's it like doing geocaching? I'm not really sure what to say here, but it does support paperless geocaching in exactly the same way you'd expect it in a Garmin eTrek series, but just a little bit slower. You can view the cache description, the hint, log your finds as field notes, and even enter the next stage of multi. The downfall is that it's very slow to load the description or the logs. It took about 40 seconds to be able to scroll after selecting to display logs on a cache, and about 20 seconds to become responsive after selecting to display the description. It even takes about 2 seconds to display the hint. Now, this is passable while doing a few caches, but if I was doing a power trail and looking for a cache every couple of minutes or so, I'd get frustrated pretty quickly. Functions like logging a cache as found or navigating through the list of caches and entering the next stage of a multi pretty much happen straight away. Entering coordinates is a bit like it is on the eTrek Yellow, if you're familiar with that, where you have to do it one character at a time and scroll up and down until you get to the right number, press a button to continue on to the next number. It does work, but it's certainly not as easy as using a touchscreen. Where the unit really comes into its own is bush caching. when you're navigating through the bush to a cache and you've got your hand held on your hand because you're following a bearing line or looking at how far you've got to go to get to a cache, it's quite annoying to have to put the GPS in your pocket, pull it out again, find that all the touchscreen buttons have been pressed while it's in your pocket because you forgot to lock the screen, so on and so forth. So having your GPS in your pocket and not pulling it out unless you really need to and just referring to the display on your watch to see that your bearing line's right or that you've got a certain distance to go or a certain distance to climb is really good. And that leaves two hands free to push through the scrub or climb or do whatever you need to do. The main page, data page that you can view while navigating to a cache or waypoint shows the distance to go, and there's a circle of dots around the outside of the face and they all light up one at a time. And so you have a double dot indicating the direction that you're going in. I've uploaded some pictures of this to the GeoTalk podcast page if you want to see this. The GPS accuracy on your wrist is not as good as a handheld. I'm used to my Montana where the accuracy is 3 to 5 meters, typically. The Phoenix will deliver about a 5 to 7 meter accuracy at the same time as the Montana is giving 3 to 5, but that's perfectly acceptable. Marking a waypoint is easy. With a long press of a single button, it'll mark exactly where you are, and then you've got the options to edit it so you can put some different coordinates in or change the name or something like that. The versatility of the interface is truly astounding. The unit has a number of data pages, and each data page is configurable with 1, 2, or 3 fields. You can select from all the different types of data that the watch can display, and the amount that you've got to choose from is truly dizzying. In each profile on the watch, the watch has profiles, just like any other Garmin GPS, if you're familiar with that. In each profile, you can customize the data pages that are shown whilst you're tracking, so with the GPS on, or whilst you're navigating to a waypoint. And so additional data pages can get added that are irrelevant while tracking, but relevant while navigating. And there's also obviously a set of base data pages for each profile that display at all times. So when I go into geocaching profile, I've customized it so that I've got 4 different data pages. One shows my navigation details. One shows my current position and my GPS accuracy. One shows the temperature. One shows the altimeter, and so on. As you scroll through the data pages using the up and down arrows on the right-hand side of the watch. With regards to displaying data, the device is far superior to anything I can do on the Montana, despite its huge screen. Another function I stumbled across recently is flashlight mode. This allows you to do a long press on one of the buttons. It clears the LCD display and turns the backlight into maximum brightness. So, in conclusion, I really love my Garmin Phoenix. It might be a bit expensive to buy at around $400, but it is a very nice toy. I used it while out bush caching the other day, and the track on the map screen was easy to follow on the return trip to re-find my way out of the bush by following the way I came in. I tell you what, I won't go out geocaching without it. Thanks, GeoTalk listeners. Bye for now.
It's time now to have a look at the GeoTalk mailbag. And first of all, an email that I meant to read out last episode but forgot to squeeze in. It's from Kevin Swain, who's the owner of mygeogear.com. If you want to check out his online store, it's mygeogear.com. He says, "Hi, Darren, could you give our new charity Trackable a mention on your show? It's for the Cancer Council of Australia, and 25% of the sale price is going to the charity, which is a good way to donate and spread the word. And it's all for the Cancer Council's Relay for Life charity event, which I've actually participated in a number of years ago, and obviously now with what I'm going through, taking quite an interest in it. The events are held all around the country, and you can head to the Cancer Council's Relay for Life website, and you can find out where they're being held and when. Most of them are occurring around March and in April, but there are some that are extending right throughout the year. But anyway, head to mygeogear.com and click on the link to the Cancer Council Relay for Life charity Trackable. 25% of the sales go directly to the charity. got an email here from Sensible Shoes, also known as Andrew, or one of the members is Andrew, and I've bumped into him many times on the geocaching trail. He said he thought he'd let me know about a conference presentation that he gave in Brisbane recently. The presentation was called Hide and Seek in the Library, Geocaching as an Educational and Outreach Tool. Now, for those who aren't aware, Andrew is a librarian up at Macquarie University here in the northern suburbs of Sydney, and he says the presentation, the aim of it was to explain what geocaching is and how libraries can use it to encourage visitors. For something a bit different, his wife went out in the morning while he was presenting and found the cache that both himself and a colleague had hidden in their workplace and tweeted about her experience along the way. This meant that the audience could follow along and see what's involved in finding the cache. Now, the presentation is available on the conference website, and I'll give you a link to that in the show notes. That's at geotalkpodcast.com. He said that it was really well received by the audience, and at least one librarian went and found the cache when they got home. One thing that he found surprising was that about half the audience had heard about geocaching before attending the presentation, so it certainly seems to be becoming a mainstream activity. Hopefully he's converted a few muggles to caches, he said. And I also should point out that Andrew has set up a cache over at Macquarie University, which I think is called, from memory, Bibliotheca Robotica or something like that, and it recently received the Geocaching New South Wales Geocache of the Month Award. It's got a nomination at least anyway. It's well worth checking out, and if you're in the northern suburbs of Sydney, check out that geocache. I'll give you a link to that one in the show notes as well. Another email here from Mark Seabee, also known as Seabreeze Oz, said, just started listening to the podcast, really enjoying them and getting lots of useful information. He listens while he takes the dog out for a walk. Recently signed up the GeoBrats, I suppose they're the kids, I presume, up to the Scouts Geocaching competition that we mentioned a few episodes ago, and he's been out and about finding all the local caches for themselves. Thanks for the tip, as they didn't know it was even happening at the time. So that's good that the podcast has got the word out about that Scouts geocaching competition. Mark goes on to say that they're planning to head off on a year-long trip around Australia at the end of April, and they've been talking about it for 5 years, so they need to get it happening. They'll include caching and waymarking post offices, of course, along the way.
Hello, my name is Veronique. I am a geocacher from Canada, enjoying my vacation here in Australia. I have seen some pretty warm weather, Sydney's highest record high of 45.8 degrees, to its very cold days and lots of rain. Geocaching has allowed me to see some absolutely magnificent views from, I've been able to drive down all the way to Eden, and find myself some really nice, safe places to park overnight for free. So geocaching has allowed me to see your country in everyone's favorite spots with not a lot of tourists around, which has been really great. So thank you to everyone who's placed geocaches along the way. You've made my trip quite remarkable, and now I can't wait to come back. So to everyone, a very happy caching, and I forgot to mention my ID name is V Good. Wonderful day to everyone. Thank you.
I got another one here from Seth, also known as Cache or Check. Says, finally achieved the well-rounded status yesterday, and was wondering how many other Australian caches are fully rounded. Now, for those of you who aren't aware, the well-rounded cacher, some people call it the Fizzy Challenge or the Fizzy Calc Challenge. It's where you try to find a geocache for every level of terrain and difficulty. Now, of course, the difficulty and terrain ratings go from 1 to 5, but they also include halfway. So you've got 1, 1.5, 2, 2.5, 3, 3.5, 4, 4.5, and 5. So there are obviously 9 of those. And if you try to find each one of them, that means one for each of them, there are 81 possible combinations. Now, I had a look at mine. I got 67 out of 81. I'm finding I've got up to 4. Everything between 1 to 4 I've got a few missing in sort of 4.5 and some in the 5 range. But Seth reckons that Fredo, Team Astro, 4Fun, Ocholio, Adrian Mack, and Marcus Vitruvius have all achieved this goal. Are there any others who have achieved it? Now, a friend suggested to contact GeoTalk, as we might know what it is. Well, we haven't done the hard work yet. We thought we'd ask you guys if you know of anywhere that lists who has achieved the well-rounded acacia status here in Australia. And also, in New Zealand, I'm taking a guess that probably Money Dork and Red Iguana would be two that would possibly have found every cache in the Well-Rounded series. Anyway, we'll leave that open to you. Now, don't forget, if you want to send in any info, including the answer to that particular question, drop us an email at geotalkpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call it in. We'd love to hear your voice. Either record it and send it via email to us, or you can send us a link through Dropbox or Google Drive or something like that, or you can, if it's small enough, you can email it through, or you can call it on 02 800 5436. If you're calling from New Zealand, don't forget 61's the country code, area code 2 800 5436. Love to hear from you. Well, that's all for this edition of GeoTalk. Thanks very much for joining us once again. Now, before we go, we better give you the answer to the trivia question. The question was, it took 3,594 days to get from one geocache to 1 million active geocaches. How long did it take to get from 1 million to 2 million active geocaches? Well, the answer is 1,068. So that's less than a third of the time it took. So I suppose if it keeps going at that rate, one would suspect it'd probably only be a bit over 300 days for the next million. So maybe we'll hit the 3 million active geocache mark sometime in 2014. It's amazing how this sport is growing. And just to give you some more stats to compare all that with, according to Groundspeak's knowledge base, they achieved 500,000 active geocaches in December of 2007, and they hit 741,000 caches in March of 2009. So you can see that the rate is certainly growing at a very fast rate. Well, that's all for this episode. Until next time, safe geocaching, and we'll speak to you again soon.